Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Conversations on Conversations, where each week we explore a topic to help us have more powerful conversations with ourselves and with each other. I'm your host, Sarah Noel Wilson, and joining me today is a bit of a fangirl moment for me, Emily Aris, and we will be exploring the idea of gender gaps in leadership. So this is a topic that is near and dear to our hearts, and I know for many of you who are listening. So let me tell you a little bit about Emily before we jump into our chat. Emily Aris is a speaker, podcaster, author, and the founder and CEO of Bossed Up, an award-winning leadership development and career services company committed to closing the gender leadership gap. Her book, Bossed Up, serves as a practical roadmap for women who want to set themselves up for sustainable, long-term career success and step up as the boss of their lives. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me. And I'm fangirling over here right back at you. So delighted to be here.
We met through our mutual friend, Stephanie Chin, and I had the privilege of being on your show as we talked about the work Stephanie and I do as my inclusion coach. And it was just such a great conversation.
Such a good one.
What else do you want people to know about you?
Let's see. I am based in Denver by way of DC. I'm an East Coaster, but my entire family has found its way to Colorado, and we love it here. And I'd say, like, it's so funny because now the work I'm doing really combines my past decade of growing a company focused on leadership development and closing the gender leadership gap with my prior roots in advocacy and activism. I'm really involved in Colorado advocacy work around the systemic forces that lead to things like the gender wage gap and the gender leadership gap. So I'm excited to bring both of those hats with me to today's conversation.
So talk a little bit about your journey to this, because that was one of the things that was so fascinating was all of your advocacy work you did prior to starting your business.
I mean, I never thought I would be a business owner. Let me say that. And I'm 11 years in this spring. So
first, congratulations on that, because we know that like most small businesses don't last.
Right.
It was, and, you know, past 3 years.
You know, touch and go there for the first couple. Yeah. But I am proud to be where I'm at, and that, you know, I only started Bossed Up because I wanted this organization to exist for my own selfish reasons. Back in 2012, I was going through a really transformational time in my life. I was completely burnt out from working and overworking for years on campaigns, working on both state and federal political electoral campaigns, policy advocacy campaigns. I had risen quickly in the world of politics as a young state director on behalf of then newly elected President Barack Obama's Organizing for America initiative. And so while I was my own boss at a very young age, like right out of college, I used to joke in a not so funny way that I was a bitch to work for. And I ran myself.
Do you look back at that and like,
you're like, ooh, internalized patriarchy, what? Yeah.
Right.
I unpacked that in my book many years later, but it's like, ooh, okay, wow, we've got work to do, Emily. So I basically burnt out spectacularly from overwork, a chronic lack of caring for myself in a culture where I was happy to martyr myself for the cause and for the campaign. But simultaneously, I was in love with and living with my partner at the time who, like millions of Americans, struggled with addiction. And somehow in all of my, you know, privileged education up until that point had not covered things like codependency. And I realized, you know, when I found myself in a therapist's office at the ripe old age of, I think, 23, that I was like fully out of my depth, that there was no overachieving my way through perfecting my relationship and my career, as was my MO as a, you know, chronic overfunctioner. And so that kind of caused me to have a bit of a recalibration early on in my career that brought me to DC, where I learned how to set some boundaries personally and professionally, and kind of needed a fresh start. And even though I was still working in politics in DC, I was proving that there was a different way to live and work, proving it to myself. And in that year of really healing and caring for myself, I mean, I went from like running my first ever 5K to competing in a Olympic triathlon, and like physically, emotionally, mentally, financially becoming stronger than I had ever been in my life. I said, oh my goodness, I want a community where other women who are navigating systems and structures that make us feel like we have to be nice and kind to the point of breaking ourselves, like bending over backwards to the point in which we break, that we can actually come together and recognize it's not me that's failing. It's a system that is failing me, a system that has taught me I have to be, you know, I have to put everyone else's needs before my own. And I started Bossed Up after a series of dinner table conversations with other high-achieving, high-performing women in Washington, D.C. said, yes, please, sign me up for that. And I took everything I learned from my advocacy life and how to create a campaign, which is great breeding ground for an entrepreneur, actually. And said, well, let's see. Like, I think this is potentially a profitable endeavor. Like, this is not a nonprofit. I'm actually looking to help a pretty privileged group of women here.
Let me
figure out if I can avoid the fundraising trap that I don't want to fall into and, you know, bootstrap my way into a viable business model. And a few years in, that was very much, I mean, we were pretty quickly selling out of our trainings. And in 2020, we went all virtual and our trainings have only done better since. So it's certainly not been without its crazy moments and stressors, but I have learned so much and I've grown up alongside the Bossed Up community who've really, we've all leveled up together.
There's so much. I took a couple of different notes because there are things you said that I wanted to make sure either we come back to right now. The one thing that you said was, I can't overachieve my way out of this. Just like hit me in the heart a bit of, and I so appreciate how you speak to the systems that set up, right? The cultural expectations that set up our need for perfectionism, our need to overachieve, our need to martyr. I mean, these are all things that are so deep in my DNA that I feel I'm working on day in and day out to push beyond or to create something different. So that I just wanted to name that. As you've been on this journey and you described it as, I learned for myself that there's another way of doing this. What does that look like for you? Because that's something I know we are so passionate about within my colleagues and I are, how do we do this differently? How do we really create a human-centered organization that still can be financially highly successful and make incredible impact, but we can do it without burning ourselves out?
I think that is a conversation the whole world is having 3-4 years now after 2020. You know, we've all been gripping in a way just to survive for the past few years that I feel like there's this unclenching that's happening.
it's such a gripping.
We all just like, we were like, we can survive this. We're just going to muscle our way, push through. And our company's bottom lines benefited from that. And I think, you know, like just for context, my background in political organizing included like labor organizing, rabble rousing. My baby sister is a union organizer. Like my dad's a workers' rights attorney. Like capitalism is so fundamentally flawed. And I'm an entrepreneur who like loves a tidy P&L. So it's just, it's a funny, there's a bunch of hats I bring to this. But here's what I'll say is that the different way that I have found for myself, which each of us have different privileges and challenges that we have to navigate in figuring this out for ourselves is what I call sustainable success. And unfortunately, like our government and our country and our corporations, they can either help create sustainable success for everyone. They can make this more accessible and possible for everyone. Or in our highly individualist world, in the Western business world particularly, we have to like kind of like muscle our way to like clawing back some power sometimes to say, what will I no longer allow so that I can give myself the freedom to figure out how to be more sustainable in my pursuit of success? And, you know, that's easier said than done. I'm working on a project here with the city of Denver where there's a boatload of migrants from Venezuela and elsewhere who've been shipped up from, you know, the Mexican-American border from Governor Abbott in Texas. And these folks are willing to work very hard. We have a labor shortage in this city and state, and yet they're undocumented and they won't be documented for any good number of time, even with federal intervention, like temporary protective status. So, you know, telling them to just like pursue sustainable success rings really hollow. We have to acknowledge how inaccessible that is to some. But if we have the privilege of being able to claw our way through our broken systems to something more sustainable, it is incumbent upon us that we do.
I'm just going to like sit and like,
I'm sorry, this is not very conversational of me, but
no,
I'm like, I'm
it's, I mean, if when I'm pausing for people who are listening,
like, right?
I mean, there's some, well, and speaking, you know, to that, that privilege and the question that was coming up for me as you were talking is I was thinking about my own journey, because part of me wanting to become an entrepreneur was first, it was more, could I do this work on my own?
Right.
But there was always for me, or not always, for a very long time, I just kept this list in my head. Someday, if I ever owned a company, how would I do it different? Someday, if I owned a company, how would I do it different than how I've experienced it, how I've seen other people experience it? And now that you know, we have a few years under our belt and we're at a place where we can start, now it's not just how do I do that for me, but how can I do that for as many other people so that they can have freedom?
Right.
And I really do appreciate that language of sustainable success. And the question that was coming up for me as you were talking about all of the inequities and not having access, right, to different resources is, what would be possible if more people could create sustainable success for themselves? What would be possible if the undocumented worker could get documented and could be able to support their family? Right. What would be possible? You know, I'm thinking about people when I run into them at the grocery store and I say, how's your night going? They're like, it's okay. This is my second job.
Yeah.
And like, man, what? Like, how do we get to a point where, and I know that that's not for us to solve. We won't solve that today, but I can't help but think about how unbelievably transformative it has been for me, my mental health, my emotional health, my relationship health, all of my well-being to be in a space that is sustainable for me.
Right.
And what would be possible in our environment, in our culture, in our community if more people could be in that?
Right. If more people could reach their full potential because they had their basic needs met, you know, and could access higher order thinking, quite frankly, right? That's a really great question to ask. And there's brilliant economists out there who can do the calculations around like how much we spend as a country or as a world because of the negative health impacts or the negative social impact of a lack of access to like, just like a, I'm not even talking about like the overnight like success story of like, look at her, she's driving a Bentley now and she's successful because she's got red bottom shoes. It's like, how about just like an access to a middle class life, like being able to send your kids to school and feel like they're in good hands, or feel like, you know, your zip code shouldn't determine your educational and life outcomes like they do in this country.
Right.
So it's just, you know, the ask isn't that high and it can be achieved, but to sort of bring up the gender thing for a moment is it's different for women because it's not just, can I be a boss? Can I pursue my full potential professionally? It's also all the other social expectations we have associated with womanhood, girls even, and just femininity, if we want to detach it from like gender identity versus sex, right? Like being a feminine person in this society comes with a laundry list of expectations to care more for others than you care for yourself. And that's truly short-sighted success. That is not sustainable success.
It, you know, that is something, I don't know when that started to become clear for me. I feel very fortunate that I am with somebody who has been an advocate for me to untangle from that, right? And I may have, I know I've told this story on another episode, but you might laugh. Mushrooms. I know Nick is laughing as he's listening to this right now.
I love that he's in the room. It's like, yeah, I know. Don't mind us. We're talking about you.
Yeah, we're just talking about you.
I love it.
So mushrooms have become the symbol for me to like.
Are we talking like magic psilocybin?
No, okay. I'm not.
Just like good old, you know.
Canned, 99-cent canned mushrooms. Got it. Okay. Because I love mushrooms. Nick doesn't enjoy mushrooms. Mm. But now to be clear, he's never asked me once in our relationship to not cook with mushrooms. Wow. But because I was raised so much and culturally mm-hmm. was conditioned so significantly to say you sacrifice for other people, your needs aren't as important. Right. For the longest time, I just never cooked with mushrooms, even though it's one of my favorite foods. And I think he just never realized it, right? That I was like withholding. And I was like, this is a symbol for so many other parts wow. of my livelihood. Yeah. And you know, beautifully so. It was like, okay, we'll make the mushrooms. I'll just pick them out and then I'll give yeah. them to you and you get more.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Like, great. That's like,
I mean, it so does, sometimes- it makes you think about what unmet needs are sneakily behind the mushrooms. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, what needs are we just unconsciously suppressing because we're like, oh, yeah. I don't really need that thing that I love having in my life, like,
yeah,
let me just, you know, just swallow hard. And like the martyrdom mindset yeah. is what I call it in my book. It's like, yeah. I will gladly fall on the sword for the people that I love. And it's like, if you take that a step further and you elongate it over the course of a lifetime, my yeah. mom, for example, is a labor and delivery nurse. She's 65, 66, 67 now? I got to double check on that. But, you know, she's been working 12-hour shifts her whole life, her whole career.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very physical work. You know, she's on her feet. She's helping women during one of the most vulnerable times you will right. ever experience in your life. She is a professional caretaker. She cares for sure. others. And then at home, you know, she raised myself and three other siblings, the four of us, five if you count my dad, is always my not so yeah. funny joke that I throw in there. But it's like, you know, she is the primary caretaker at home and always has been. And what was the cost of that? Well, it really was exercise, sleep, taking mm-hmm. care of herself physically. Mm-hmm. And that has a compounding effect, right? Just like not yeah. saving for retirement has a compounding effect.
Yeah.
And so I just yeah. wonder, you know, it is interesting because if you look at burnout and stress, men die earlier on the whole.
Yeah.
Men physically have their own set of stressors attached to patriarchy and their gender right. roles are very mm-hmm. constraining in their own way. But like yeah. literally, what are you giving up to be the wife, the daughter, the mother, the sister, the boss, the friend that you think you need to be?
Mm.
Like, that is the question, because hopefully it's just mushrooms. Like, hopefully that's as yeah. bad as it gets.
No, I've untangled
okay,
a lot.
We've
but
read
like,
that.
I mean, but the good thing is I'm in a good place. I have a good therapist and I have a great husband.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
So I've been able to shed a lot. But
yeah.
every once in a while I'll be like, oh, right, I'm deferring to you. And I I had to train myself because it wasn't even so much
yeah.
dismissing my needs. I wasn't even listening to my needs.
Right.
You know, like that took training
yeah.
to say, no, actually, I don't want that. Actually, I do want this.
Right.
Or I am going to spend time doing this and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And not even realizing how, I can't think of the word right now, but I mean, it was just the air that
totally.
Breathed, right? Coming from the martyrdoms, right? Very much. And just how do we break that? One of the things that you talked about early in this conversation that I'm curious to get your thoughts on is that idea of realizing that so much of the pressure and stress we can feel, particularly as women, yeah. are the systems and the structures. And it makes me think of the whole dialogue and discourse around the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, it was Rushika's article, and I forget her.
In HBR, yeah,
the HBR, and we'll share it in the show notes. But it was such a provocative article
yeah.
to say, stop telling women that they're not confident and look at the systems
right.
that are not who we don't get rewarded. We get punished right. if we're too confident.
Right.
We get told we're rude. We get called bossy. We get called right. Like right. all of that stuff. So I'm curious just to get your perspective of how you have been
yeah.
thinking about that or how that's showing up in the clients you support.
Well, I wanted to take this in sort of two parts. One is that article is phenomenal. It's Stop Telling Women They Have Imposter Syndrome. And there's yeah. two real key reasons why we should stop telling women they have imposter syndrome. One is it's not a fucking syndrome. This is not yeah. a diagnosis. This is right. not a clinical.
It's not a bacterial infection.
Yeah, you can't catch it. Like, it's just a misnomer. It makes it sound a little more official than it actually is. So I like to use the term imposterism. And the other,
oh.
right, it's a great alternative, just imposterism, yeah, yeah. right? But yeah. in my keynote titles, that's still imposter syndrome because yeah. that's what people know it as.
That's so what people know.
Then we change it, right? So imposterism, the other reason we shouldn't tell women or folks of color that they have it
yeah.
is because everybody has it. We have to normalize yeah. the widespread nature of imposterism. It is a normal sign that you're not a megalomaniac. So <Yeah. laughs> if you think, hey, there's a big new shiny promotion, I'm going to go for it, I feel no self-doubt, you probably are an egomaniac, right? Like, so it is a sign of growth that often hits right on your growth edge. So when you yeah. are expanding your identity is what I call it in my book, like when you're going through and navigating a moment of identity expansion, can I be this fierce? Can I become a mother? Can I become a business owner? Can I become a leader in my organization? Like those are moments where you're not just changing what you do, you're changing who yeah. you think you are.
Yeah.
And so of course you're going to feel like a fraud because you're in the midst of some sort of metamorphosis when it comes to your own identity, right?
Yeah. I really appreciate that perspective. And last year we had Neha Sampat on and we talked about this. And one of the things she added to this conversation was an imposter syndrome, right? If we refer to it, or imposterism, often shows up when you're having to exist in systems that weren't built for you.
Right, right, yes.
But I do appreciate that idea of you're rethinking your identity,
right.
you're rethinking what's possible. And in some cases, right. some of that is also clawing your way through a system.
Right. Well, I that, think there's a yeah. key difference here between belonging and like self-confidence, right?
Yeah,
like self-efficacy,
for sure.
agency, confidence, self-doubt. I lump all of that under imposterism. Mm-hmm. But it's very closely related to, do I belong here? Right, yeah. which is thankfully is finally making its way into the like widespread vernacular around DEI is now DEIB in a lot of organizations, mm-hmm. right? B for belonging. Mm-hmm. Because if I have created a company in a white supremacist culture, mm-hmm. In a patriarchal country, right? Like, of course, women of color and folks of color and women in general might not immediately feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And so yeah. here's the thing, like, no one goes around the world thinking, hello, I'm a woman. Like, nice to meet you. I'm a lady, right? Like, none of us identify first with our gender. Some people might, like, have a very niche identity culturally. Like, my mom was born and raised in Bogota, Colombia, right? So, you know, if she meets a fellow Colombian out in the wild, like, you'd bet she's going to raise that first. Like, that's a big part yeah, of her identity,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But you don't just go around the world, like, identifying with your gender explicitly. And yet, holy shit, gender, it implicitly impacts yeah. everything. Yeah. And so it's like from how our school system was designed, which, by the way, benefits young girls because we are really good at perfecting, performing, and pleasing, which shows up later in a detached yeah. sense of our own desires, right? What yeah. the hell do I want? Yeah. I don't know. What do you want me to be? I will be that, yeah. right? We train our men to be stoic as little boys, like stiff upper lip, boys don't cry. And then, you know, 30 years later, we ask them to open up to us so we can be right. emotionally connected. Like, gender is everywhere, but it's so implicit that yeah. it's our individualism focus in the Western yeah. world. 99% of the time, women who come through our programs at Bossed Up go, I need to work on my I don't know, visionary influencing skills. I need to work on my persuasive and assertive communication. And really what's underlying all of that, and to be clear, I've had a bit of a feminist existential crisis in the last year, reflecting on the ways that I have been complicit in reinforcing that presupposition that it's you, like hire me and I will help you, when in fact, it's the whole world we live in that has caused women to adapt in those ways, to try to please everybody all the time. And it's like, I liken it to tap dancing on a tightrope. You want to be nice. You want to be seen as caring. You want to be seen as conforming to traditionally feminine stereotypes. So you don't want to ruffle feathers, but you also want to be respected. You want to be seen as boss. You want to be seen as a leader. And it's like threading those two needles just feels like a tap dance on a tightrope. And for women of color, it's like adding a juggling act on top of it all.
Right, right. It's, we'll be talking with Dr. Allison Fregale. She's got a book coming out this fall called Likeable Badass. And it's all about, the behavioral science, right?
Wow.
Of what happens to women and how do we set women up for success? And that double bind bias is so, it's so real.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you spoke to, there is a gender bias. There are gender rules that do not serve people who identify as males either, right? Like they are often don't know how to be in intimate relationships.
Right.
They don't know how to be emotionally aware for themselves even.
Yeah.
And it is that balance of the likability.
Totally.
Like I can't be too bold.
Yeah.
I can't be too confident, but I need to, I can't be demure. And it's this constant, this constant wrestling of how do I just show up in a way that's just me? Knowing that some people are going to respond to that and some people aren't.
And there is no just me. Right?
Like
we all contribute to culture.
Thank you.
Contribute to culture and we are all influenced by culture. So what I actually see happening, Sarah, is like, I think we're culturally in a moment where we're on a quest. We are on a quest right now, and you'll see it all over social media, for what does it mean to be a good man and what does it mean to be a good woman? Mm. And in an era where I am grateful for our LGBTQ plus pioneers who have, you know, pushed back on gender as such a binary and acknowledged the performance that is gender and the social construct that is gender. There's this gripping again, I'll say there's like a grasping, one might even say, at no, I need more clarity than that. I need to know what it means to be a good man. And I need to know what it means to be a good woman. And so that's where we get the trad wife hashtag, traditional wife, right? And like this return to like bread baking and traditional femininity, and the mommy wars of the 1980s are like coming back with new branding. And it's just like there's just a desire for confidence that you're doing it right.
Yeah.
That like, it just, it belies like a really deep insecurity, I think, that we have as a world around what a woman or man should be, or anyone should be. How do you be in this world when gender is just like, it's like crumbling beneath our feet?
That's so, that's really, I'm going to chew on that a bit.
It's
after
tricky.
This conversation.
But don't worry, no HR department is having that conversation right now, because that's about 40 years ahead of the curve, right? Like this is like the bleeding edge of these discussions that...
Yeah. And the thing that I've observed is I hear you from that standpoint of I want to do it well and I want to do it right. And let's name the like the right versus wrong is also very white supremacist.
Totally.
Right? Like, you know, thing. But there's also as the narrative is shifting, again, largely because of the push from the LGBTQ community of kind of questioning those norms and questioning the identity or the rules or the roles. That the other thing that I've seen that is really beautiful is an accepting of, I don't fit those rules. I'm not the traditional.
Yeah.
I don't fit the traditional masculine patriarchal norms. And like, how do I be okay with that? And that's something we've actually talked about quite a bit on the show. And Nick has actually shared his story, so I'm not sharing anything that he hasn't already shared. But a lot of those gender roles and gender norms contributed to a lot of mental health challenges for him, right? And so like, even that challenging. But I want to go back to something that you said Yeah, and we have a global audience, like I know you do. So we're speaking very much from like a Western American culture,
right,
where that individualism, and it's interesting. It's mm-hmm. something that is something I continues to percolate for me of how do I shift from that into more of a community and connection? Yeah. But I really appreciate how you're earlier bringing up about the like, well, how do I get better at this? And how do I, like, how do I do this right? Instead of like, how do we show up for each other? Yeah. How do we want to, like, what's the culture we want to create?
Right. And I feel like there's no right way to do it.
Right.
Right. Because like, I'm not saying individualism is bad. It's just something to be aware of, right? Like, I think there's some really great things about individualist societies in some ways, but we are kind of bowling alone, right? As the book title would go, in that we've really are experiencing a social isolation mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And that's the price we pay for being individualists. And so you do need to kind of figure out what's the balance here, because I'm not saying conformity across culture is good.
Right.
And, you know, I am arguing that like Workers United are definitely a better, you know, bargaining unit than you on your own, for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's just like reaching for the right tool for the right job. So what is it that we're trying to do? Not to say individualism is the wrong approach for everything, but it's like, what am I trying to do? And if it's, you know, I'm trying to, you know, solve for the mental health crisis that's impacting our country, particularly teenagers right now, particularly teenage girls right now.
Right.
Society, community, connection is the antidote. And there's a lot of different opinions on how to inject society with more connection.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different soapboxes I could get on there. I would argue that the workplace discussion around this, especially as we debate return to work, return to office mandates, adds an interesting layer to like social connection that you choose versus social connection that is forced upon you.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that was something that became when we were starting to come out of the pandemic is, I remember when we were in it saying to the companies who were moving, who had to, right? Because it was most, I understand that remote work during a pandemic is very different than remote work not during a pandemic.
Right.
When people can choose to be in community, they can choose to spend time with folks instead of being so isolated, right? That total isolation wasn't helpful for anyone, you know, really.
Right.
And being mindful of that. And again, that's part of the, for us anyway, right? The how do we do it differently is how do we help people have more time to have relationships with people they want to be in relationship with?
Right. And I do think there's a lot of countries that are getting that right, right? Like a collectivist culture is one that puts public health above personal rights, personal need, right? Yeah. So like we saw those mask mandates and isolation mandates during the pandemic go over swimmingly in more Eastern parts of the world, right? Where it's like, the collective need for this trumps my individual rights. And then of course, Americans had a viscerally different approach.
Right, right. And even that was dependent on states.
Absolutely. Right? Well, like, there's so many kinds of Americans.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just,
I remember talking to some friends, I'm like, wait, people are actually wearing masks.
Yeah.
I'm the only one, it feels like.
Yeah. So it's just like, it's a great example of collectivism versus individualism, though. And it's like, okay, apply that to social isolation. Apply that to the gender leadership gap. Like, in an individualist society, helping close the gender leadership gap feels like a threat to men.
Yeah.
And in a society that sees that men dominating almost every leadership position across every industry as a societal failure, right, as a social not good thing for this world, can take a more collective approach, right? It's like the pie can get bigger. It's not, I'm arguing for more pieces of the pie for me. So it does sort of play directly into this winner takes all mentality that in, you know, you look at the American tax code, it certainly feels that way when it comes to inequality and wealth. So we're traversing so many topics that I care deeply about here that I love.
I want to focus in on a specific component of the gender gap in leadership. So for folks who may be unfamiliar, let's just level set, right? Mm-hmm. The gender gap is substantial. Mm-hmm. Right? It's, was it McKinsey?
So the latest data.
The Lean In.
They have a great report every year, but the March 2023 data I saw that was cited by LinkedIn, which is very similar to the McKinsey, finds that only 32% of leadership roles are occupied by women. And the proportion, this is a direct quote, the proportion of women in leadership positions has increased by 1 percentage point since 2016.
Hmm. Yeah. And then when you look at the data of entry-level positions, the distribution is very different and then becomes even more. And then obviously there's some industries more so than others. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work with financial industry. And that's something where 60% of employees are women.
Yeah.
And then it drops to 2% of the top leader. Mm. We'll be back with Emily Aris in a moment. One of the things that has been an evolution for me and my colleagues and friends and some clients is this idea of what do I want leadership to look like?
Right.
What does it look like to lead for me when for so long it was through a very masculine, patriarchal norm?
Yeah.
And it's been fascinating because I see even gentlemen, like I have male clients who are starting to examine it and have moments of, you mean I could approach this differently?
Totally.
I'm a 62-year-old man, and I've always wanted to lead more relationally, but I was always told you can never do that because you can never be an effective boss.
Yeah.
What, you know, as you are working with women who are maybe deciding to step into those positions of power and authority in a formal way, what do those conversations look like that either you're having with them or they're having with themselves? Because I know that there's things that I remember asking a coach, you'll appreciate this. I remember asking a coach once, what if I'm too empathetic as a leader?
Yeah.
And she was like, that's not a thing. Like, that's like, that is a lie that you've been told. And then she said, well, what would that look like?
Yeah.
But what I was really describing wasn't being too empathetic. It wasn't holding people accountable. Those are two different things.
Woo, and, Sarah, we got a lot to talk about. Okay.
Give it to me.
Well, first of all, I would argue there is too much empathy is real, and it's in one of my programs. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But I'm going to put that aside for one moment and say, if you recall, I mentioned that our world kind of conditions women to perfect, perform, and please.
Yeah.
It makes us really good students. There's a reason women have been outperforming men academically for 40 plus years. We have more degrees. We are more educated. Black women in particular are increasing degree holding like faster than any other population in America, at least. So it's just like we are doing the work. We are getting the degrees. We are in the student debt, right? It's happening. And then that completely changes when you look at our professional arena.
Yeah.
In fact, entry level, women are kicking butt and taking names. Like we're doing all the work. We're perfecting. We're performing. We're pleasing. We're great with client services. We're empathic. I mean, these are all the skills you want in individual contributors.
Yeah.
And then the first promotion from individual contributor to first-time manager, everything goes haywire. That is where the gender leadership gap explodes. It is largest at the beginning of women's careers. Hmm. So this is different than the anecdotal evidence we have around, oh, well, she's opting out because she's having a kid at the midpoint.
Yeah.
A lot of college-educated women are having kids around the midpoint of their career. So that's got to explain the gender leadership gap. No, they're already behind by the point of the midpoint of their careers. The first step up into leadership, McKinsey and Company and Lean In coined the term the broken rung of leadership to describe that for every 100 men who are promoted to manager, only 87 women get that same chance. And the number of women of color is even less, 76 Latinas and 54 Black women. So it's like that is where this explodes and never recovers.
Right.
So the idea that we're solving for this, it's getting better, is a total fallacy. In fact, it's there's no evidence that this is getting better. And this is what I say to the women who come through my doors at Bossed Up. The skills that got you where you are not the skills that are going to get you where you want to be. Perfecting, performing, and pleasing is not what we want in managers. And I'm not saying that the traditionally masculine archetype of leadership is the only constraining way to lead, but there are some things that men in leadership have historically done quite well, like being visionary, not being so bogged down in the details, like envision Hillary Clinton in the primary campaign against Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton had plans. She had policy documents. Mm-hmm. She had fully thought out, footnoted evidence on her website saying, here's how we will reform this system and that system and affordable childcare and all of this stuff. And Barack Obama's like, hope and change, baby. You know, like inspiring vision for not a red state or a blue state, but a United States of America. And what is more inspiring in our leaders? We want visionary, compelling leaders who are not necessarily bogged down in the details. And that is a really hard mindset shift for people of any gender, but especially women who've been rewarded for being on top of the details their entire lives.
Yeah. How does, you know, when you think about the making that shift from the perfection performer pleasing, you know, how do we then navigate also just the reality that there is a bias, right?
Totally,
there is, right? The fact that there's more, what is it? There's more CEOs named John.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget what the study is than women.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's more CEOs who are 6 foot four or above 6 foot three. And so some of it, I hear you, some of it is like, what are the skills we're developing? And, and there's just still the reality that people, you know, it's, we were on a call today and it, and somebody used the analogy of, well, the CEO, he's the head, but his secretary is the neck and she's actually the one who's going to control.
Like,
and it was just such a fascinating.
Yeah. And she's not getting paid properly.
And she's not getting paid properly.
And she's running the org. It's
and
so,
she is running the organization.
It's so frustrating. Right. I mean, I had like a shame response when you started saying what you just said, because there's this optimistic brown-nosing overachiever in me still who's like, if we just train all the women, you know, if we just if we just get ourselves fitting into a patriarchal, then we'll get there. And you're so right. Like, that is not the whole puzzle, right? Like, that is not the whole game here. It's like, no matter how, even if we play gender dynamics, you know, gender gymnastics perfectly, and we act machismo when we need to be and caring and empathetic when we need to be, and like, that's the tightrope tap dance, right? If we,
even if
we hypothetically did that perfectly, we can't control the perception that others have of us. We can try, but we can't. And this is doubly true for women of color, right? Who are up against not only the gender stereotypes, but all the racial stereotypes that come with all of this, or age stereotypes.
Or age,
height,
that's what I was going to say.
Or any of those things. So it's like, well, here's the here's where I'm landing on this. And this is an evolving dystopian, you know, crisis that I'm in the midst of. But I am what I call a pragmatic progressive.
Yeah.
In that, I believe there are better ways. There are ideal, fantastical cities on a hill where gender is not relevant. And I also don't think that's the strategy that I'm pursuing. I am very much compromising. Like, the whole,
it's not, I mean,
yeah, the whole premise of
it's not the system we're in.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's the, like, there are things I don't love about capitalism. That's the system we're in.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, it's the reality of what we're in.
Yeah.
So how do we play in the container that we have to play in to be most effective? And, you know, and it's not just the bias against women, right? It's also the familiarity bias. It's the, oh, he reminds me of me. And spending time on the golf course and whatever.
Proximity bias. Yeah.
Right.
In the office. All of it. All of it.
Yeah. All
so
of it.
So it's overwhelming. That's the thing. It can easily lead to paralysis, especially for the most marginalized. Yeah. Okay, I have a woman in my program who is a wheelchair-bound woman of color, right, who has been rising in the ranks in our federal government as a leader. And she came through our Level Up Leadership Program, and the undertone of her entire situation was, I'm pissed. And we were like, I get it. The whole cohort validated her, made space for her to vent, and was like, you have every right to be pissed about the ways that our society has failed you.
Yeah.
And let's get down to business. What can we do? How can we help you, like, chisel away at the broken systems that you're navigating to get something better out of it? And by the end of the program, she had a promotion that was actually kind of a double step up on the GS scale in a totally different agency that didn't require her to move, that, like, was so much, like, it was amazing to see her demeanor change over the course of those 6 months, because it was so beyond what she was aspiring for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I'm trying to basically help women game the system that has already been rigged against us.
Right.
And it's not that it's just to benefit women, right? Because everyone could use a better game, a better system altogether. But it's I think often of the phrase that was coined as the motto of America's first black women's clubs. And the phrase is lifting as we climb. I'm often viewing my work in the most idealistic way as climbing. We are climbing alongside these other women. And then we're going to go advocate for affordable quality childcare reform too, because we got to lift everyone up with us. Or we're going to, like, get that promotion to a director of marketing at a corporation, right? But we're also going to advocate for affordable housing in our community, right? So it's like, there's a place for systemic change. I can't do that all day. I can't. I feel like I need that sensation of individual progress that I can get through helping women at Bossed Up. And it is a deal with the devil that each of us has to make, I think, honestly.
I think that is so well said. And you just, you choose when do you compromise and when do you not? Yeah. And when do you go, okay, like, if I can have impact on one or two people, if one or two people can feel seen here, if one or two people can potentially consider a new way of doing it, or if nothing else, just consider that their lived experience isn't the same as everyone, then maybe that'll make it worthwhile. I adore you, and I love everything you're doing, and it's so needed, and on multiple levels, right? Like, it's just, we're better when we get more voices in the room and different voices and different ways of being, and also rethinking what can effective leadership look like, and what do we bring to the table?
Thank you.
I know that I could just keep asking you lots of questions, but I want to be respectful of your time.
I do feel like if there's one caveat, I don't want to leave anyone hanging on the empathy thing.
Oh, yeah. Give it to me.
Can we unpack that for a second?
I want to hear your perspective on it.
I don't remember which training this came up for. So I have an organizational client that we've worked with for years. And we created a custom first-time manager training for their in-house fast-growing organization, nationwide organization. This is across the gender spectrum. And like many organizations that have leaned into creating a healthy workplace culture, they're total people geeks is what I would call them. Probably like you, Sarah, right? They're like all about great leadership, all about empathy. They have described their culture at times as being so people forward that it can actually backfire a little bit. Like accountability, as you named earlier, can be challenging. You know, follow through can be challenging. 70% of their managers didn't do their year-end survey because they were so busy being present and mindful for their guests and for their fellow workers, right? So it's like that kind of thing, like basic follow through. So anyway, you know, they rightfully pick the right battles as an organization, which is people first. But in one of our trainings around emotional intelligence, we talked about what too little empathy looks like, which we all know, like not listening, not recognizing your own or others' emotions isn't great for any workplace. But what does too much empathy look like? And it's not being able to, like, leave work at work. At the end of the day, like, I am still ruminating. I'm feeling other people's grief, other people's frustrations, other people's loss constantly, right? And that's not good for our healthcare workers. That's why healthcare workers are burning out and navigating alcoholism and addiction at higher rates, right? That's why our air traffic controllers have a, like, you know, a tenure of like 5 years tops or something wild like that, right? Like, too much empathy can backfire in the form of burnout.
Okay. I really appreciate that perspective. because I think sometimes when I hear people push against too much empathy, that's not what they're talking about. They're basically like, I kind of don't want to have to care for my people. So isn't there such a thing as caring too much? But what you're saying is
caring so, so much that you're gone,
that there's actually a significant cost to you, which I completely agree with you. Right. And I really appreciate that, because also I'm imagining being able to go, well, so I got had an opportunity to interview Emily Harris. You're totally going to get quoted on this now. And here's how she describes it, that, you know, there's going to be some people like, well, shit, that's not what I was thinking of. I was just trying to be able to get out of listening. Yeah. Like, I don't actually want to listen to
or
my
care.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or care.
Caring too much is not something we have to worry about here. Yeah.
Right. Right. So I am glad we closed the loop on it. And I really appreciate hearing your perspective on it. And what a beautiful example. This is something that's so important in our work and practices. How do we just constantly check for understanding?
Right.
Because when you're like, no, I think there is too much empathy, I had a little reaction like, oh, I don't know, we'll see if I agree with that or not. And I was like, oh no, I totally agree with you, actually. And then you went a totally different direction than how I thought about it.
You're like, so you need to command and control people, Sarah. That's what I'm here to say. Yeah, no, that's so funny.
No, I love it. Okay, Emily, since you're a first-time guest on our show, we always like to ask the question about conversations that have been meaningful for you. And I always invite our audience to think about how would you answer this as well. So for you, what was a conversation that you had with yourself or with someone else that was particularly transformative?
So I'll try to make this brief, but I had a very specific conversation with my grandmother, Norma, who is Panamanian / Colombian. They were the same country for a while when she was growing up. And her whole life transformed when she married an Irish-American soldier who was stationed on the Panama Canal Zone, who became my grandfather.
Sounds scandalous.
It is very scandalous. He whisked her off to America, and then they pursued their American dream with systemic help of, like, you know, what is that housing legislation that helped veterans get houses and stuff? All of that good stuff, right? Thank you, Uncle Sam. And white privilege borrowed from my grandfather, right, for her. So my grandmother knew firsthand, like, what it meant to totally transform her life for the person she loved. And she had experience kind of helping her sister escape from a really abusive relationship. She literally went to her house one day. This was in Ohio. She had to, like, fly there and said, pack your bags. If you stay here, this guy is going to kill you. We are getting out of here. She got some money by convincing the car salesman who sold my great aunt a car to buy the car back, and they fled, right? So she has extracted her sister from an abusive marriage. And so when I was stuck or feeling quite stuck, respectively, many decades later, having a lot more privilege than she had and than her sister had, but feeling rather stuck in this toxic relationship with a wonderful, caring, high-achieving elected official, head of an organization who also happened to be an addict, who was not even remotely ready to acknowledge his addiction, and who had made it feel like it was all my fault, right?
Oh, sure.
At 22. I asked her, Nani, how did you get the courage to leave? Or how did you ever get the courage to transform your life around someone you love, right? Like, basically, should I stay or should I go? And to her credit, she didn't pry. She wasn't like, well, why are you asking? You know, instead, she just laid it out for me and said, look, you just have to do what you have to do. Like, you find the strength you need to make the choice you know you need to make, and you just do it. And I'd left that conversation like, damn it, if she had so much less, you know, just to work with, and was able to advocate for herself and her sister, I can advocate for myself. I don't need to be liked by everyone. I don't need to be performing what looked like a great relationship to the outside world. Like, I can do the hard thing. And it was very shortly after that that I extracted myself from that relationship, which was easier said than done and felt very dangerous and precarious and many times. So that was like the beginning of me taking charge of my life and being what I think of as the boss of my own life. And I have my grandmother Nani to credit that with.
That's so beautiful and powerful and also challenging, and appreciate you sharing that and also speaking to the fact that you can speak to it articulately now, but that doesn't mean it was easy in the moment for anyone who's experiencing it. But that, so say her advice again. You just find the courage to do whatever.
You just find the courage to do what you got to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she was so plain about it. She was so, you know, as many decades after for her, and I was in the thick of it. So it's kind of like me saying that to anyone else now who's in the thick of it, who goes, yeah, right. Right. Yeah. And I remember there was a defensiveness like, but how? And she was absolutely right. You do it without them being happy with you. You just do what you have to do for yourself, you know, and for your own well-being, whether or not other people like it.
Yeah.
I always say, you know what I say? This came into the form of a manifesto we have at Bossed Up, which is be selfish, not always, but not never.
I love that. I love that. I love you and I love everything you do. And someday we need a future conversation on like boundary setting and all of that. Now I'm going to add you to my quote wall of be selfish sometimes, but not
never. Always, but not never.
Not always, but not never. Yeah. I love it. Emily, for people who are curious to learn about your programs, to work with you, to have you potentially come in and work with them, what is the best way for people to connect with
you? Well, first, wherever you're listening to this podcast, go subscribe now to the Bossed Up podcast. Go check out Sarah's amazing episode with Stephanie Chin. And bossedup.org is the spot. Bossedup.com, whichever one. I could buy .org first, so they both are my website. you can see how to book me as a speaker for your organization or how to work with us for job seeker and leadership development training.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing, and keep doing it, and come back again, please.
Thank you for this conversation. This was a delight.
Our guest this week has been Emily Aris, and I'm so glad that our paths have crossed. It was such a treat to be in conversation with her a second time on this show. And one of the things that I'm thinking about is, when do I try to overachieve my way out of something? And I couldn't help but think about a comment that my therapist said. Sometimes we can't think our way out of it. We have to just like come outside in. So that's something I'm holding on to. And also that language she used over and over again of, we try to be perfect, we try to perform, and we try to please. Such a powerful and clear way to talk about the challenges that women face. And we want to hear from you. As always, let us know what resonated for you, what came up for you, what questions came up for you. You can always reach out to us at podcast@sarahnoelwilson.com, or you can check me out on social media, where my DMs are always open and we love to hear your thoughts. If you want to support the show, please rate and review our show on your preferred podcast platform. This helps us get exposure so we can continue to bring on great guests like Emily. And consider becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/conversationsonconversations, where not only you'll be helping support the team that makes this show possible, but you also get access to early ad-free episodes as well as exclusive swag. So win-win and a win. And big thanks to our team that makes this show possible, to our producer Nick Wilson, our sound editor Drew Knoll, our transcriptionist Becky Reiner, our marketing consultant Jessica Burge, and the rest of the Snowco crew. Thank you. And then just a big final thank you to Emily Aris for her advocacy, for her insight, and for her willingness to meet the system and try to do something different within it. My friends, this has been another episode of Conversations on Conversations. Thank you all so much for listening. And remember, when we can change the conversations we have with ourselves and others, we can change the world. So please rest, rehydrate, and we'll see you again next week.